by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make the heaven the middle of it. Grass make the heaven the middle. We are grass make the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. We've got just really a fine guest this evening, and we've got him coming in from Florida. Welcome to our program, Dr. James Tracy.
Hi, George. Happy to be here.
Well, tell our listening audience, if they haven't, the listening people that haven't heard you before on our program, we've had you a number of times, and we really have enjoyed your insights. But tell our listening audience a little bit about your background first, would you?
Well, I'm professor at a university in Southeast Florida, which I'll not mention for the moment. In part, that has to do with, I guess, the controversy that has brought me some notoriety in the past few years, and I teach mass communication, media studies, and political communication, and I also research that topic. Over the past few years, I have had a blog called memoryholeblog.com, and a lot of the pieces that go up there also appear at Global Research. And since December 2012, I've been looking into the Sandy Hook massacre and the media representation of that, and what are other types of things that are surrounding that. And since April of 2013, looking at the Boston Marathon bombing and commenting on and analyzing other areas as well. But those two events I've spent quite a bit of time on. So that does. It is informed by my background and training in media analysis and the relationship between media and politics, media and political institutions, media and society, and media and the economy. Received my PhD at University of Iowa and master's at Arizona and undergrad at Cal State, at San Jose State University.
Right.
And I've been teaching in the present position since 2002.
Right. Well, you have a wonderful background, and you're a wonderful guy, and you've really put the truth out there. And sometimes it's been tough to get it out, has it not?
Yeah, I guess that I sort of walked into something I didn't really expect back in January of 2013 when I began kind of piecing apart the media coverage of the Sandy Hook massacre. That was, you know, a very sensitive topic, and it affected a lot of people at an emotional level. Biggest mass shooting in the country's history. And so it was something that was controversial to wade into, and I had no idea that I would sort of be ambushed by the major corporate media over the course of about 10 days or so.
Right. Well, I tell you, it was hell, and you've stood your ground, too, and I respect and honor you for that. Recently, you participated in a Veterans Today project discussion, mm-hmm. and so forth, and I think there's an article up on veteranstoday.com listing 10 reasons that are questionable about Sandy Hook. And, you know, that raised very important questions. And one of them here is, let me just tick this off. We'll go through this, and then we'll get into the Boston Massacre and some alternative news and your opinions on that. The proof of death, was it suppressed on the Sandy Hook by the government, state government, or what?
Well, it was something that the Newtown town clerk, in collaboration with some of the Connecticut state lawmakers, sought to suppress in terms of the death certificates. They did not want them released. And generally what they would revert to was this idea that, well, this is something that disturbs the families, you know, the victims' families and so on and so forth. But nevertheless, this is something that the public has a right to know, to be able to confirm these deaths and what have you. So there was an effort to suppress the verification of the deaths. And to this date, the verification has not really been made public. It was something that was given, I believe, to the New York Post. They wrote a piece on it, but largely it's not anything that's actually circulated and made more broadly available.
Right. The parents were not even allowed to view their children's bodies. Is that correct? To identify
that's another
them.
Thing. Yeah, that's another thing that's really unusual. If you could imagine being a parent, and I certainly am, and there's nothing that would stop me from seeing my child's body if there was an event that took place like that. Yet we saw no such activity of that nature following the event. So that's really rather unusual, nor were there any lawsuits that were brought forth.
Right.
There was one that was brought forth, and that was quickly dismissed because you have to have approval by the state claims commissioner to sue a state-funded institution, and the state claims commissioner is the son of J. Paul Vance, J. Paul Vance Jr., and, of course, we know that Paul Vance was the spokesperson for the Connecticut State Police. He was put in that position in 2012.
Right.
And they turned that down. And, in fact, that was not even for a family member who was affected. It was for a child of a family. The family brought suit because the child was traumatized by the sound that was coming through the PA system at the school on that morning.
Right. Okay, number two, emergency protocols were not followed. It looked like that those vehicles around the school were perfectly lined up next to each other, like it was. That would give credence to a good argument that it was some kind of an exercise that went bad, or was it just an exercise? What are your thoughts there? Emergency protocols were not followed.
Well, it looks as if there were a great many emergency vehicles there, but the bodies, for example, were left in the school for well over 12 hours, which is rather unusual. You would have had, for example, medevac helicopters there that would be transporting the injured and the deceased to the hospital so that their deaths could be verified. They might be resuscitated depending on what their, what their capacity, what their status is. None of this is evident from the information that we have. The autopsies were allegedly done on site, which is really rather unusual. You don't have the medical equipment and so forth there to be able to properly conduct the necessary medical procedures. So all of this is unusual. We don't know who actually declared these children deceased, or the school employees.
Right.
There were mats that were put outside the school itself on the school grounds, and these are color coded from mild injury to deceased. But none of those were used. The alleged corpses once again were kept inside.
Number three on this was drill protocols were followed instead. Drill protocols were followed. What do you mean by that? It seemed like that they just were acting out some kind of a drill then, huh, at times?
Yeah, and in fact, a number of the emergency responders were turned away. They could not actually go into the school. There's one particular officer in the Newtown Police Force who did not even abandon his post until 11:30 that morning. Now, if there's an event of that magnitude, every law enforcement officer and emergency response personnel member is going to go to the school. But that did not take place. So what is suggested is that there was a that this was an elaborate drill. And I've suggested that in the past. I know that's controversial, but once again, looking at what appears to have taken place, there are a lot of elements there. There are a lot of specific characteristics that do, in fact, suggest this.
Right. Could it have been a drill that went bad for in some kind of on level or not?
Well, it may have been more than one. This may have been, in fact, where the footage, the aerial footage that some analysts initially saw and sought to kind of piece apart of the absconding gunman going to the back of the school and then up through the woods. That may have been one particular drill. There may have been several that have taken place that day. The reason I say that in part is because if this just took place and it was completely, no one was aware of it, how would the helicopter be there all of a sudden to capture an event that took place over a very short period of time?
Right.
There must have been prior notice.
Yeah, so one of those. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, so, that's just one element. But, you know, as you know, George, and probably a good many of your listeners, these drills are taking place all over the country, and they were taking place before Sandy Hook, and they're made to be extremely lifelike. So it's difficult to discern between whether these are actually taking place or whether they're drills. They could be carried out, and you have a variety of emergency responders under one particular umbrella that are acting as if it is in fact taking place. Some of them may not know, as well as is the case with some of the victims. For example, some of the school personnel or some of the students, they might not actually be aware that this is taking place. I read
right.
a piece about this back in August. There are over 100 FBI personnel who have gone through a particular program. They're spread out all over the country to help coordinate these drills. So it's one of the reasons, in fact, that I chose to take my daughter out of the public school, because she had told me that she had gone through a lockdown drill. She didn't know what
right.
it meant, you know.
Right. She didn't.
And does not to this day. But still, it could be. It could be quite unnerving for,
right.
especially for young people.
Right. Number four, there was foreknowledge of the event. The Connecticut State Emergency System was taken over long before the massacre occurred, with a frequency change implemented 5 hours in advance of the shooting. Normal police and EMS dispatch protocol using the Alpha Phonetic System for communication between officers and dispatchers was replaced with staged transmissions by non-trained personnel. What's that all about?
Well, typically, if the most law enforcement emergency response personnel, particularly law enforcement, will use Alpha Phonetic. So if they're going to read off a license plate number, they, you know, will A, Apple, B, Boy, C, Cat.
Right.
And this is something that was not done in the recordings that have been released. So this is originated from a piece that was written by Dennis Camino and Jim Fetzer that also originally appeared on Veterans Today. And Camino is an expert in this particular field of
okay.
radio and electronic communications. And this is what they found out. And I took a particular excerpt. It was part of a larger article, and also included that on my blog. Got quite a bit of circulation, and there was quite a bit of interest in it.
Okay. Okay, number five, there were contradictory reports about the weapons, okay? And I saw this Carver guy talk about this AR-15, said all of them were shot with that, you know, with a rifle. But he was actually, it was almost too relaxed, and he's almost laughed at times during the interview. I mean, what the contradictory reports about the weapons, what, you know, there was many, weren't there? Several.
Well, yeah, and this was something where they turned on a dime during the interview with H. Wayne Carver as well. when all the reporters, this took place at around 3:15 p.m. on December 15th, the following day after the apparent autopsy, all the reporters believed that it was handguns that was used. There were two handguns, apparently, and this is also what Lanza used to commit suicide. But then suddenly it was the AR-15 that was used, and Vance had to actually correct one of the reporters who said, well, wait a minute, we thought it was handguns that were found. Now it's the AR-15.
Right, all kinds of inconsistencies, backtracking, denials of what they'd said before, all kinds of inconsistencies, right?
Exactly, and that contradicted statement by Pete Williams of NBC, of course, formerly of the Pentagon spokesperson, who that morning of December 15th contended that it was handguns. And then there was a shotgun that was allegedly found. And as is pointed out in the article, Fox News at one point even said that a shotgun and shells were found in the glove compartment of the Honda.
And then Carver says that there were several of the children were shot several times, you know, by the rifle. You know, I mean, they'd say something, he'd laugh about something, you know, just chuckle or something. Okay, number six, Adam Lanza cannot have done the shooting. He was a frail man, 120 pounds, Asperger's syndrome. Asperger's syndrome, and he carried this massive weapon in with ammunition. What do you think?
Well, I think that those who would contend that he could have done that was because there were, you know, the children may have been bunched up, and so he may have been able to do this. But the idea of bringing in the number of weapons, the rifle, the pistols, and also being in body armor or the equivalent, going into the school, shooting his way in, it really just not that doesn't fit his character, his build, and to go ahead and carry this out. We know that he's made up to look like this very scary, nightmarish, ghoulish figure with the photos that have been circulated in the media. But it's unlikely that he would have been able to do this also with such a high degree of precision. You know?
Yeah, I mean, the way Carver acted, like they were shot several times, you know? And children that would be running around or struggling or whatever, that would be really difficult to do, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I know also that... you know, there's the argument that he had visited rifle ranges and the shooting ranges. But that's another thing that's really unusual is that there should be CCTV footage of he and his mother doing this if they frequented these ranges to the extent that is suggested. Him attempting to purchase weapons. I mean, this is something that news outlets themselves would jump at the opportunity to circulate and to play up. And yet we don't have any of that. We don't even have any footage of him, for example, doing simple transactions at, say, a supermarket or at the gas station, as was the case frequently with Christopher Dorner, you recall. You know, the former L.A. police officer who went on a rampage. There was footage of him that was circulated. This was, I believe, back in February.
Right.
No similar footage of or no footage or anything of the like of Lanza and any digital footprint that he might have left.
Okay, number seven, key participant displayed inappropriate behavior. I jumped ahead a little bit, but I was talking about Wayne Carver's sort of clowning and outlandish behavior. What do you think?
Well, that's what initially tipped me off.
That was a tip-off right there that this was no, other than what they're portraying it to be.
Yeah, and when I sat down to write the second piece that I wrote on Sandy Hook, which was in late December of 2012, I transcribed much of his interaction with the press. And I had to, you know, you had to stop and start and stop and start the recording in order to get the questions from the reporters and his response. And I couldn't believe it. This guy is supposed to be a medical practitioner. I grew up in a medical family. My grandfather and uncle were physicians, and you know they passed away when I was pretty young. I didn't know them very well, but I got a lot of stories and things like that from my parents. And one thing that you I think learn from those who practice medicine is that you are careful, you are precise, because you're dealing with a human being's life.
Right.
And that struck me even more so and stuck with me. The idea that this guy is acting like he is when he has just presided over the autopsies of the most tragic mass shooting in the country's history, and it's like a sort of...
He would have had his head hung low, been very depressed and very upset looking. This he was.
Absolutely. But that's the general... You can sort of ascertain that from a great many of the interview subjects, him being one, of course, but also there would be a fear, a trauma, a terror among those in that community, even if they were not there on the school grounds or in the vicinity. There would be something that would be visceral that one could detect, and that wasn't evident. So that's something that stuck out to me, and I know that it's not anything you can necessarily put your finger on. It's more of kind of an aura of a sense, it's kind of a zeitgeist of that community. But it just did not really shine through.
Right. Robbie Parker says here perhaps the most famous press conference that when Robbie Parker, the alleged father of victim Emily Parker, speaking on a CNN report December 15, 2012, he chuckles as he walked up to the camera, then gets into character by hyperventilating and finally feigns distress as he talks about his daughter and about the fund set up to raise money for Emily. Boy, that was off the wall, wasn't it?
Well, I thought so as well. I thought along the lines of H. Wayne Carver's activities and his,
yes.
You know, before the press, before reporters.
Exactly.
And a lot of internet researchers have pointed that out as well, and others have come back and said, "Well, you know, that's how you act in an event like that." But it's not just Parker. It is a whole number of these parents that really they don't appear to be mourning or at all. And after you've lost a loved one, especially a child,
you're going to be distressed, upset. You're not going to want to talk to anyone sometimes.
Right.
You know?
It's got to be, yeah, it has to be an extremely, extremely profound experience.
Okay, number eight, photos at scene and victims look staged or fake when they were leading the children with their hands on each other's shoulders. What's your view there and comment?
Well, my take in part there is that that's the one of the very few photos, and there's no video really of a mass evacuation of that school. So it's just rather unusual that is the only photograph that we actually have. Now that was, I'm not certain as to whether or not that was even taken on that day. The individual that allegedly took it, a woman by the name of Shannon Hicks, who was an associate editor at the Newtown Bee, she claims to have gone on the school grounds at the same time that the police arrive, which is around 9:40 a.m., depending on which timeline you're looking at. And I contacted her, and I asked her whether or not, because she claims to have rattled off a whole bunch of photos. And I said, well, what happened to those photos? I mean, this is crucial, particularly if there were bullets that were, you know, being emitted from the school going into the parking lot. Who were they? I would imagine that law enforcement must have those. Who have they been shared with? And she responded by saying they've been shared with no one, and they're not going to be.
Right.
What type of an investigation yeah, what type of investigation is this? And then she said, you know, don't contact me again, so we're fine. But,
well,
that's
yeah, there were, like, photoshopped photographs left and right all over the place.
Well, those as well, yeah. A good many of them look as if they are doctored, for example, with the Parker family.
Oh, yeah, there was a little girl that was portrayed as one of the victims, and her mother said, no, that's my child, she's still alive, you know?
Yeah, it was a photographic image that was, like, taken off of a Facebook page.
Yeah, Facebook. Okay, number nine, the crime scene was completely destroyed. That's just been recently, hasn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, these are echoes of, for example, Oklahoma City, when just a couple of months after
9/11, yeah,
or 9/11, exactly,
right,
yeah,
right.
Or you know, any of the major assassinations back in the 1960s. Look at, you know, the limousine that JFK
yes.
was in,
because right.
it was airlifted to Detroit, you know, to Detroit and gutted, and similar situation with RFK. You know, the Ambassador Hotel Pantry. So, you know, there's a record of this taking place. And so I was not too surprised when there was funding appropriated by the Connecticut State Governor, Donnell Malloy, to the tune of $50 million back in September, mid-September. And within the
right.
course of 3 weeks, that was approved and accepted by the Newtown community, and they leveled that school by I think by late October, early to mid-November, it was pretty much gone.
Right. Okay, number 10. Now, this one is mind-boggling and blowing. Deceased children sang at that Super Bowl, which was in 2013, right? What's that all about? That's the first time I've ever heard of that one.
Well, I think that is the most unusual and perhaps the most difficult to believe, and it's based upon a video
right.
a comparison of images of still photographs of the apparent victims, and then those the children that were singing at the Super Bowl in 2013, and
right.
The likenesses are striking.
Okay,
they're really something. Now, there has to be, there should be a record something from the school district that allows for the release of those children to travel to the Super Bowl and to perform. And that's something that we're looking into in terms of a public records request. The names, the identities of the children and the parents were never put on the program by the NFL. Now,
really?
What
my gosh.
Right. So we don't know who those children are. And that's the most unusual.
But this was like a tribute to them, right? The singing and stuff.
Exactly.
So it was a tribute to the victims, you know, of Sandy Hook and Newtown, and we're going to have this group of singers but they didn't really specify in the program who they were, is what you're saying, but it looked like they were from Newtown, and would they have used younger photographs? Is that of the people they're singing? Is that in a composite of this?
It appears as if the children are 10 or 12, and the photographs that were circulated upon the particular event in December of 2012 was when they were 5, 6, 7 years old.
Oh, okay.
So it looks as if they're about 5 or 6 years older, all of them. And again, I think some of the likenesses from the photos that were circulated upon the massacre event to the Super Bowl are really uncanny. I mean, you might think, okay, maybe one or two, and that's a coincidence. But when you have, you know, 6, 8, 10 that are very, very similar
right.
in overall appearance, I think that's more than that is likely more than a coincidence.
Right, right.
And,
you know, the whole. Yeah, the whole thing just didn't have a feel of an actual real massacre, catastrophe, you know what I mean, a very sad, filled, depressing massacre of that many children. It didn't have the feel about it that I didn't see. What do you think?
Well, I didn't think so either. I still don't. There are still, you know, too many unanswered questions.
Yes, yes.
And yet, at the same time, and I think maybe some of us can argue that, oh, well, it's, you know, that's happened, it's gone. But Sandy Hook is in the news every day. And there was just a story this past Thursday about how Rhode Island has approved a new, like, 324-page safety protocol for all of its schools. And what do they use as a rationale in part? Well, Sandy Hook. Same thing happened a couple of weeks ago in California. You know, so there are now these state initiatives that are prompted by this particular event in terms of school safety, in terms of, you know, concerns over mental health and what have you, and Sandy Hook is being used as a basis for this. It's always harkened back to, so it's something that has been really, you know, kind of integrated into our public memory, into the popular memory, as a basis for these state actions. You know, some of them involve gun control or safety measures, but overall, it's a move by the state. And they're using tragedy as a cloak to tighten up these particular measures and to enforce or implement new measures. So, you know, again, it's still with us, that's why we need to know. It's the same with, of course, with 9/11. You know, that was an event, a tragic event that no doubt took place, and yet it's the rationale for the war on terror and for why we got to go through these crazy, you know, shenanigans at the airport and so forth. So, still important that we revisit it and find out what actually took place.
Well, that's why really the work that you're doing is very difficult work, but I think it's needed because there's just too many different inaccuracies, inconsistencies, backpedaling, reissuing of different facts that should have been tacked down from the word go from the beginning. And it's just a tragic that it was, and it unfolded like this, you know?
Yeah, I think so too. Although, you know, there were alternative media outlets and independent researchers that I think did attempt to ferret things out and to make sense of things, but That's also something that's kind of difficult to do and at times discouraging when you have major corporate media that are going the complete opposite direction and they call everything that might be considered a conspiracy theory and the like.
Yeah, they can dismiss a lot of people with those kinds of allegations, can't they?
Absolutely, yeah, and especially, you know, if I certainly caught the brunt of that because of, you know, my position and raising these questions, and these should be relegated to, you know, late night talk radio and YouTubers and things like that. Nothing we can seriously address, right? Because the
right.
Folks, that's the way it is.
But yeah. Let's move on to our second subject tonight that we, you know, agreed to cover, and that's the Boston, bombing. What happened up there? There's all kinds of oil hanging over it, oil connections, Chetney into Chetney and so forth. What happened there, James? What really went on, do you think? Tell us something about that.
Well, that's another, you know, rather, it's a touchy topic. And I know that there are varying and conflicting theories about what took place, but the photographs suggest, the photographs before and after suggest that the thing was staged, that the pyrotechnic devices that were detonated, you know, 10, 12 seconds apart, could not have caused the havoc that is indicated in the reports. You know, the shrapnel wounds, people losing their limbs and things of the like, these did not take place, at least, you know, to the extent that they were reported, that the injury figures themselves were largely inflated made up to a significant degree by people who were suffering hearing losses and, you know, alleging PTSD. They're saying over 250 people, upwards of 270 or so people suffered injuries. Now, there were not that many people in that in the vicinity of where those bombs detonated to you know, actually make claims, although these claims are being doled out by One Fund Boston and other charities that have been set up by the alleged victims. And there's no, you know, there's really very little evidence that the Tsarnaev brothers committed these acts, which themselves are at the very least questionable. And yet they are hunted down. And they are, at least one is executed, right? And,
yeah.
Yeah, the other one is shot up, and we're not even sure what his status is. We have to accept the statements of the feds in that regard. We're not really sure who appeared in court back in July. But he was very, you know, he had sustained this, you know, this manhunt and what have you, the younger Zohar, and then was hiding in the boat, and photographs that were leaked suggest that he was in awfully bad shape when he finally surrendered. So anyway, the idea that this can be done, and you know, these young men apparently had some connections with intelligence and may have been asked to be in the vicinity at the time, but I don't believe that they were involved. I think the thing was largely contrived. It took place after really the marathon was for the most part over with. The video that appeared, I posted on my site. A lot of the foreign journalists in particular were in their hotel rooms filing their reports. And as soon as the bombs or whatever they were, the detonations went off, there was law enforcement going through the hotel, like within 20 seconds or so, telling people to stay in their rooms.
Really?
That's pretty, yeah.
That's too fast.
It sure is. So they, you know, they wanted to try to seal things off. They wanted to keep most of, you know, any journalist that might exercise some integrity and file reports critical of what was taking place there. They wanted them cordoned off. So the one outlet that was more or less commissioned with presenting the story was the Boston Globe. And, you know, there's one particular video that was widely circulated about the aftermath of the bombing. I recall seeing that evening. And yet there was no actual, whoever this camera person was, this videographer, they didn't tilt their camera down to get any of the carnage. You know?
Right.
So that was really unusual. I mean, this is supposed to be apparently a journalist who was you know, capturing this footage. But the scene itself and the aftermath was tightly controlled. Journalists that were not approved were not allowed to be there. We have testimony from a lot of pedestrians who were, you know, they were put up against the wall. And so the overall thing also suggests that it has the trappings of a drill.
Right.
And I'm generally, I'm fairly confident that's what took place. I wrote a piece last month on One Fund Boston as well.
Okay.
And what's interesting about looking into the legal papers, you know, on that particular charity, that, by the way, has collected over $60 million now.
Oh, my gosh.
Is that it consists of two individuals. One Fund Boston consists of two people. James Gallagher, who is the chief counsel and one of the top executives of the John Hancock Company, which
okay.
is a subsidiary of Manulife, which is, you know, it's a transnational insurance and investment conglomerate. But they're the principal corporate sponsor of the Boston Marathon. So John Hancock, with James Gallagher, he appears on the paperwork, as does a Michael Sheehan, who is with the ad agency that was overall promoting the Boston Marathon. They were commissioned by the Boston Marathon. So Michael Sheehan is the head of this ad agency. He just made a move to the Boston Globe as a consultant this past month in January.
Really?
So these are the only two figures that are on the One Fund Boston paperwork, the legal paperwork, which, by the way, was filed on April 17th, 48 hours after the events, less than 48 hours after the marathon bombing. This paperwork to establish One Fund Boston is filed.
Really?
And they had a website up and running less than 24 hours after the massacre. Imagine that, less than 24 hours, so that, you know, the Evils on Ev brothers are off, you know, they're still at large. You've got these apparent amputees in the hospital suffering and so on and so forth, undergoing repeated operations, and yet these guys are clamoring to open up, to begin this charity so they can start collecting money. Doesn't really make any sense as far as I'm concerned. And, all these legal documents are date-stamped, and they're on their website. So
God.
That is just really unusual, the fact that, you know, these are the head honchos that are involved in organizing the marathon itself, are also involved in setting up the charity and doing so quickly at a time when, you know, the city's in, you know, near lockdown to capture the culprits, the Zarniev brothers.
My gosh, yeah. it's just too much. Again, you know, now the American public. Let me ask you this: they're going for these kinds of events, are they not? And just believing them directly, for the reports off of television. And I know the Sandy Hook, they did one blue screen thing or two, you know, that came out later. But are they just believing point blank what they see on the television, the main media, or what? What's going on within the American public?
I'm afraid a majority are. And,
right.
As it is presented, now we're looking at it a little bit more deeply, obviously, but as it is presented to the average person, and I don't think it necessarily matters whether or not that person is, you know, highly educated or otherwise. You know, the Boston Marathon was especially convincing to, you know, even the more, you know, educated professional, what have you, because it appeared on the New York Times the following day in graphic detail.
Something
that I noticed, and, you know, I prompted me to write more so on it and to interrogate it more so. But, yeah, when these drills take place, you have all of the emergency response personnel incorporated, involved in particular roles. And when this includes medical personnel, that's really very compelling.
Yeah.
If you have physicians who are you know, attesting publicly to the injuries that were sustained and things of the like, whether it's Carver or what have you, I think that that's really very difficult to dispute. And yet, all of the personnel involved in exercises such as this are mandated more or less to go along. And this includes press conferences and things of the like as well. One of the things that really caused me to be a bit more skeptical of the Boston Marathon bombing was when I was looking at some of the interviews with alleged emergency response workers, nurses on the scene following the event. I mean, they were being interviewed like at about 4:30 or so.
Okay.
And so that was like 90 minutes after the event apparently took place. And, you know, like with Sandy Hook, you would expect for them to be mortified. You would expect for them to be very, very unnerved. They've just treated people who are bloody messes, who've had to go through amputations, who've lost limbs. I mean, this would be an extremely traumatic event, even for the caregivers. And yet, they look really rather blasé. A series of these nurses. In fact, if you look at the Boston Marathon bombing timeline, I transcribed a particular episode of this interview that took place over several minutes of these nurses, and even the information they're presenting, they're providing to the broadcast journalist is inconsistent. But again, it's their overall countenance, the way in which they carry themselves and respond to questions. They just seemed a bit too casual to me, quite a bit too casual. If the event of the marathon bombing, the magnitude of that really did in fact take place just a short while before.
Boy, I tell you, what comes to my mind is back in the 30s, there was a radio project that was funded by the Rockefellers, and it came up with feeling states. I don't know if you've ever heard that term or not, but feeling states were generated by short little musical ditties that became songs, see?
Yeah.
And yes. would something as terrible like this, with imaging like this, would that create some kind of an emotional feeling state of some kind that could be at a deeper psyche level than normally, you know? And that could, when you put, I know this, when you put people into an agitated or an emotional state, you can begin to influence them on a much stronger basis, a much greater level than you could if they were in a normal conscious state but not emotional about anything. See what I mean?
Yeah, and this is something that I think is being designed it's something that no doubt we know is being monitored as far as, for example, how these events play out and are received via social media.
Right.
So there's a project, for example, at the University of Colorado that's funded in part by the Office of Naval Intelligence that looks specifically at how these events are received via Twitter. And really? Yeah.
You mean a Twitter a person that tweets or whatever? A Twitter.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Either
yeah,
receiving,
I mean,
or doing it or sending a both sides or what? What?
Well, how information is
transmitted. Yeah. Okay.
How fact and rumor are distinguished from each other? All these events generate all of these types of communication, and so it's something that is being closely looked at by those in power, by the powers that be. And the way I found out about the marathon bombing, for example, was because I was online, and I got a pop up, I got a pop up filter, but I got a pop up on my, now it may have been on Yahoo or what have you, but
okay.
Nevertheless, there was something that came across the screen saying there's been this event in Boston and you know, terrorist event, what have you. But you know, you think about the extent to which technology has advanced just since 9/11, since 2001.
Sure.
These events, I believe, they're designed to a certain degree, but there's no doubt the fact that they are being there's a good degree of data collection that goes on, and also there is study concerning how the events play out and are received by the public. So you would have, as my observation suggests, you have a greater degree of anxiety, if not kind of trauma and terror, experienced by the broader population than
right.
by those who are at ground zero, as is the case with, like, the Boston Massacre. If the nurses that I saw interviewed are any indication of this,
right.
you know, there's just this more general kind of, oh, you know, this event took place. And, you know, I think it's also the tyranny of the consensus, the idea that, well, they said that, that you know, we our media said that it took place, and apparently it did, and who's to really question that?
Well, you know, the NATO secret armies or the left behind, you know, and the false flag stuff they were doing in Europe, it caused a tension. Now, this is causing a great tension in the country, is it not, these kinds of events?
Well, yes, and of course, it's also rationale for you know, additional types of programs.
Yes.
In terms of, you know, school security or
a lockdown, right? Security.
Yeah. And you know, putting more security forces and the equivalent out in the streets, out on the roads, and not to mention the whole element with regard to Sandy Hook of mental health protocols, right? Because
right.
if Adam Lanza is able to do what he did, and he had this more or less benign condition called Asperger's, and was more or less a, you know, just a cool, you know, he was not malevolent, he was not bitter or anything of the like, he was just kind of quirky and unusual. Well, who knows? Who knows who might be next, and that might somehow erupt into violence. Everyone has to be on edge, because it could be, you know, your next door neighbor. And so, yeah, in that regard, I think that we are experiencing another, you know, we are at least perhaps experiencing something along the lines of a Gladio.
Right, a Gladio operation. Yeah, that's what. Now, also, you have the media, the mainline media, or whatever you want to call them. They're predisposed to a certain way of thinking about guns and some of these, in a sort of a liberal sense. Would you not agree or what? So they're looking for ways to bring the country back to their way of thinking, and so it seems like that they're normally going to write, you know, on one side of this issue, and it's going to be biased against gun rights.
Yeah, I think that's overall the case, and you know, with a handful of exceptions, but for the most part, it is generally geared towards reducing Second Amendment rights, and that's definitely a big part of it, to scare the population. I think that may very well have been one of the reasons that the whole scenario has changed at Sandy Hook, from the pistols to the AR-15, which looks a lot scarier and it
more
looks
sinister looking, isn't it? It's
exactly.
Yeah.
Even though it's just a semi-automatic rifle, you know, that has a fairly small caliber slug, but nevertheless, it's something that it looks intimidating. It's called, you know, an assault rifle.
And when Wayne Carver said several of the children were shot multiple times, it really put a cast over the whole scene, like, oh my gosh, poor little kids being shot several times. You know what I mean? It just put a very depressing, very hateful against these kinds of guns and against these crazy, whacked out guys that would use this gun to kill these little children. It was highly emotional. And they really got to the deep down on the American psyche, it looks like to me.
Well,
they got them.
Yes.
They got them on this one.
Yeah, and there's the misimpression that it was an automatic weapon. The idea that many shells could be got off in such a short period of time. There's the idea that when in fact, of course, it was not. In fact, I think there's something, that's one of the things that I looked into, and some other researchers as well. It was semi-automatic, and if that in fact is the case, the amount of time that would have been necessary for him to fire, you know, 150 rounds is beyond the amount of time that was allotted in the timeline anyway.
And the timeline was too tight to fire that many rounds, and several of the children, according to Wayne Carver, were hit several times. Now, that is preposterous, see?
Yeah.
It begins to be an impossibility of action, see?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, especially
given the situation and the children and this young 120-pound man, you know, Lanza, and then being able to accurately fire that much, that quickly, and kill that many children with multiple wounds in some of the children? No, I'm not going to believe that. I don't believe that that was the case. But what is the best overall thing on Sandy Hook that you could come up with? Would it be strictly an exercise or a combination of exercise that went wrong? Or, you know, what is the best possible explanation right now, considering the facts that are available?
Well, I'm reluctant to call it a hoax, and I'm not
right.
the person that actually chose the title for
right.
The article.
So you wouldn't call it that, right?
I think that's awfully strong, but
that
I
is strong. I think it is too.
And I don't think that that's anything that necessarily wins over any individuals who might be on the fence.
Right, right.
What I would suggest is that, you know, again, there are a number of very questionable elements, characteristics of the event itself, and I think that it It may very well have been an exercise, and there are, you know, there's an overwhelming number of pieces of evidence that, that suggest that, or a series of exercises. That's my impression. That's my judgment. And you could call it that, but you could call it a hoax, but that's, you know, awfully strong. I mentioned this, you know, on a piece back that I wrote back in December, early January of 2013 that was quoted out of context and what have you, but I had mentioned the idea that to what degree does the Department of Homeland Security, federal agencies under it, actually have in terms of creating an event such as this? Well, they commission with a group called Crisis Actors in Colorado.
Right.
And there's, so, you know, they contract with them. Now, that's a fact. Now, is there the possibility that a similar troop of actors may have been employed in Newtown? There's a possibility of that. I mean, I don't know for certain, but it might help to explain all of these rather unusual, you know, the nature of these interviews that that did take place, and the questionable identities and so forth of some of these individuals,
right?
As well, you know, we haven't heard anything from, for example, H. Wayne Carver. You would think he'd be on the talk show circuit. He'd be a book, and you know, he'd be all over. But last time he was in the public eye was on December 15th, and say similar things about some of the other individuals as well. Overall, the people that have been wheeled out in front of the camera have been the parents of the children, and they have all been for gun control.
Right.
You know,
we've got a couple of minutes in concluding. Any final statements or anything you want to say in a couple of minutes here?
There's a piece that went up on the blog today, and another piece on Sandy Hook. And,
okay.
It centers on a particular individual.
That's memoryholeblog.com, is that right?
Yes, memoryholeblog.com. And I read a piece about this Al Barbarotta, who is Governor Donnell Malloy's best friend. And interestingly, he's a contractor. He's a major contractor for metropolitan areas in Connecticut. And also, what's interesting is the fact that he was at the Sandy Hook School on December 14th. He was there at the crime scene itself. Now, this is rather unusual. He was apparently called by the Education Commissioner's office and to go there and to put up plywood partitions isolating the crime scene. And he remarks to the press that
that's another red flag of cover up or something, you know.
Yeah, this guy is
crazy
the governor's
stuff.
Best friend. This is the governor's best friend, and yet he's there right at the scene within 24 hours. He has no medical credentials or law enforcement credentials, but there he is on the scene. And
it goes on and on, doesn't it, James?
Yeah, interested individuals could go and take a look at that if they wish. And just another piece of evidence that suggests there's much more here than the eye, or perhaps much less.
Well, they can come into our site and replay this if they wish to, and if they miss it on this air broadcast, it's Saturday night. So, thank you very much, Dr. James Tracy, for all your work and your fine delving into this and research and trying to make sense out of something that's very difficult. But we certainly thank you for being with us this evening.
Okay, George. Yeah, thanks to be here again.
Okay.
To be here again. Thank you.
Huh? Okay.
Bye-bye.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Bye.